right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll. And guess what? It's Friday. So here we go with the returning Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Chris Jericho. Hello there. It's Duff McKagan calling you. Happy New Year to you and all your listeners out there, Chris Jericho. You know, the jokes have been, everybody went on vacation for the holidays and whatnot, and the jokes kind of did the same. The joke muscles, a little soft. However, well, you know what the most cowardly pasta is, Chris?
No, Duff. What is the most cowardly pasta?
Chicken Alfredo.
Thank you very much.
I love it, Alfredo. So good. Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Duff McKagan from Guns N' Roses. Never disappoints or even delivers with the joke of the week. And send your joke of the week ideas to me on the Twitter at Talk is Jericho, and we'll see if they're good enough for Duff. All right, today it's all about true crime tales with Dave Schrader, host of Beyond the Darkness podcast on the Jericho Network, back on Podcast One. We've moved on to Westwood One. Beyond the Darkness stayed back on Podcast One. All good stuff, though. Dave does a weekly true crime podcast, though, as well as 5 days a week with Beyond the Darkness, and he explores real crime stories and cases, some involving the paranormal. Podcast is available on Patreon, and you can get new episodes commercial-free every Tuesday. So Dave's going to share a few of those cases and stories today, crimes involving the Slenderman, Ouija boards, and ghosts. We'll also talk to Dave about some other famous murder cases, like the West Memphis 3 and the Stephen Avery case, which, of course, was featured in the next Netflix documentary series, Making a Murderer. Dave was actually into the Avery case before the Netflix documentary came out. You'll hear what he thinks and what he discovered in his own interviews with people who were involved in the case. This is it. True crime tales right here with Dave Schrader. Let's delve into it. Lock your doors, lock your windows, and let's check it out now on Talk is Jericho. So, Beyond the Darkness, one of my favorite shows and a huge hit right now on the Jericho Network. But Dave Schrader is here, and you also have another show called True Crime Tuesdays that you do on the Patreon site. Is it Patreon site? Is that what it is?
Yeah, Patreon. And if you go to patreon.com, /True Crime Tuesday, you'll find our program. We deliver every Tuesday a brand new 90 to 120 minute episodes. So we tackle different weird crimes, bizarre nature crimes, and then we try to round it out with some dumb crimes and stupid criminals to lighten the mood at the end of the show. But we've been delivering that for quite a while.
And you were talking about this long ago when we first started talking about bringing Beyond the Darkness to fruition. You were mentioning that you had True Crime Tuesdays as well, or you were doing a true crime show and you wanted to kind of launch that. So how did you get, we talked before about your paranormal kind of interest. How did you get involved and interested in true crime stories?
Well, here was the deal. When we were doing our show for Darkness Radio, and we were on iHeartRadio as part of their lineup, we just found that there was this kind of weird natural marriage between the paranormal and true crime. And we started finding these true crimes that sometimes had a supernatural or paranormal slant to it. Vampire killers, people that thought they were werewolves, occult murders, Ouija board murders. So we started doing those, and we found this huge groundswell of popularity. So we ended up turning our Tuesday shows straight into True Crime Tuesdays. And we did that for a number of years. And then when we came over to your network with Podcast One on the Jericho Network, I know we just wanted to focus primarily on giving you the best we could with paranormal and doing that 5 days a week. So we wanted to launch this as kind of a separate entity so we could still give listeners that were intrigued and interested in following the true crime a place to follow and listen into the show. But my background in this is a little bit more on the personal side. I have unfortunately had tragedy hit my life on a few occasions, and my first girlfriend in high school, Debbie Evans, real sweet girl, very nice. She had very strict parents, very religious upbringing, so she wasn't officially allowed to have a boyfriend, but we were definitely hand-holding in the halls and a quick peck at the end of the day, boyfriend and girlfriend for a while, and stayed friends for a number of years. And in 1988, I was waiting for the arrival of my firstborn son, and she was waiting for the arrival of her firstborn son. And we struck up a friendship again. And it had been quite a few years, I think about 5-6 years since we had dated. And just just friendship. We started hanging out and talking, and I'd help her out. She was living kind of in squalor and didn't have a whole lot, so we'd go out and get things for her apartment to help set her up and get her life on the clean path. The father of her son was kind of an abusive guy, so she had asked me, would you be willing to possibly put your name on the birth certificate as the father so that this guy can't take him away from me in the future and do this? And, you know, I was going off of what I knew at the time, and, you know, just being her friend, I said, sure, that's fine. Put me down as the dad so that nobody can take him away from you. And that was the last I heard of it. We talked about names, and I helped her name her son. And all these years later, I'm at home, and I'd gone to college, Winona State. She'd been in contact with me and had reached out a few times. She was, you know, hey, Dave, it sounds like Winona's great. Should I move there? Should I reboot my life and kick over there? And I said, well, you know, certainly, I mean, it's a change from Chicago to Winona, but yeah, this wouldn't be a bad place to go. But we never really took it past just the initial kicking it around stage. And we weren't looking to couple up or become a thing, but just in that keeping friends and trying to get her out of the situation she was in. And I'd gone home to visit once in Illinois and went over to visit her at her apartment and met her boyfriend at the time, Laverne Ward. And something at that time, Chris, I got to tell you, and I know it's easy to be the armchair quarterback on Monday morning and know all the problems, but something set off my spidey sense when I met Laverne.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't put my finger on it. And it wasn't, I mean, he was a very large black man, but it wasn't like he was mean or nasty, and it wasn't a racial thing to me, because, you know, I knew that she had dated African-American men for a while, and that's not a big deal, not a part of my world that's a problem. But there was just something off with this guy, and I couldn't put my finger on it. Well, a few years later, my mom calls me, and it's November, and she says, Dave, you used to date Debbie Evans, right? I said, yeah. And she said, I got some bad news for you. She's been murdered. And I shook my head. I'm like, no, not Deb. She goes, yeah. And I guess they murdered her daughter and they're looking for her son.
What?
Yeah. And the story hadn't even completely unfolded at that point. So I started trying to read the news online, anything I could get to figure out what was going on. And this was kind of at the beginning of internet information. So I was digging up anything I could find on her and what was going on. They started covering it on the news in Minnesota, where I was living at the time. So that's where I was, unfortunately, getting some of this information. And then the true gruesome nature of this story unfolded. And, you know, this story is not for the faint of heart. So if you have listeners that maybe are a little sensitive, this might be the part you tune down for a few minutes and then come back. But what had happened was Debbie had been dating Laverne Ward for quite a while. They had a child together, and she was pregnant with their second child. But they had broken up during the pregnancy. But she was remaining friendly with Laverne. And Laverne's cousin and girlfriend, I think it was girlfriend, I can't remember if his cousin was the girl or the guy in this, Fidel Caffey and Annette Williams. They were related to Laverne Ward, and they wanted a light-skinned baby. And Annette had been fixed, so she couldn't have a child anymore. So they concocted this idea, and she began faking a pregnancy right along the same timeline as Debbie, telling everybody she was pregnant, getting ready for this pregnancy, getting ready to have a baby. And a week before Debbie was due, they went to the apartment to visit, as they often did, to see her other son or their other son and hang out. And some point during the night, they shot Debbie in the head. And then Annette Williams, using a pair of scissors, removed the baby from Debbie's womb.
Oh, my gosh.
Then they went into the bedroom and stabbed her daughter, Samantha, to death. Now, Joshua Ryan, her little boy, had hidden in the closet when he heard all of the things going on. They left the apartment and left Laverne Ward's other child sitting there in a pool of his mother's blood with this dead woman. They just left him, and they walked out of the building carrying the newborn. And Josh saw his chance and made a break for it and ran out the back door and unfortunately ran right around the building right into them. So they grabbed him, spent the next day torturing him before killing him and dumping him in a dumpster. And I believe it was Maywood or Melrose Park in Illinois, something like that. So they had made a fatal flaw by taking him to a friend's house and saying, hey, can you watch this boy? His mom was killed in a drug deal gone bad, and we're trying to get help. And, you know, Annette's about to give birth. So they went through all of this nonsense, but left him there, and he began to talk about everything that he'd seen and done. And the family he was left with were terrified, so they didn't know what to do. They certainly didn't want to put themselves in the crosshairs now. So they waited, and when they came to pick Josh up, that's when they started torturing him and trying to do things to him, and then ended up driving away with him and stabbing him and throwing him in a garbage dumpster. That came back to bite him in a big way, because they made his story to this family admissible in court. So that really helped to seal the deal for them. But they did find all three of them. They found blood-soaked outfits and items. They found the baby on them, everything. So this was kind of a baptism by fire into the world of real true crime. And it was horrifying. And to think that there's one person out there, you know, you hear about these serial killers and sometimes these one-off killers, and you think, what happened in your brain? What made this okay for you? That's hard enough to wrap your head around. And then you hear about the Bonnie and Clydes, the Starkweathers who partner up with somebody. And you think, okay, well, it's a man and a woman, a relationship, and maybe they're just broken enough that this makes sense. But now you've got three, and there's possibly a fourth person involved in the story that they were never able to corroborate. Joshua had said who was involved and referred to another person as Boo Boo, I believe. But they could never figure out who that was or what had happened, who that other person was. And they were all put in, and they were actually given the death penalty. And outgoing Governor Ryan decided to commute all of the death penalties to life in prison without, parole, which I understand. And that's because there were so many more cases that were popping up of, DNA exonerating people that weren't guilty of these crimes. Mm-hmm. So I understand why he did that, and he did it in a blanket way. So they're in jail. What breaks my heart about it is, you look and two of them are on inmate dating sites. So, they're allowed to live this, although incarcerated life, they're reaching out and trying to have relationships with people, and it's allowable, which I don't understand. But this brutal murder and multiple murders took place, and these three people came together to create this scenario, do this horrible deed, and just thought they were going to walk away. I couldn't understand that concept. So I started reading everything I could on true crime and killers and why they would do this. And, we're led to believe that there are profilers who put together these packages. And at first, we used to hear they're the bedwetters and the fire starters and they abuse animals. And we found that a lot of that isn't even true anymore. That was kind of a generic base at first. And now they're starting to find that a lot of these killers led regular lives. Sometimes they're hyper-intelligent. They're not remedial in intelligence. So just kind of reading into these things and educating myself, it really helped to kind of help me try to transition and process this heinous crime that had happened in my life. So that was kind of my indoctrination into the real world of true crime.
And like you said, Dave, I mean, that's just a horrific story, even just involving the light-skinned baby. It's just insane. But there is a lot of, I don't know why, but it's definitely in the same ballpark as paranormal stories. Obviously, this is real. Paranormal is people are subjective to it. But there's so much kind of a crossover there. And I want to hear more of the stories that fascinate you. But I also want to ask something that you mentioned earlier when you said vampire killers and people who think they're werewolves. What is that all about?
Yeah, you'd be amazed if you start doing some research online. To kind of kick it off, what inspired me on that was the story a few years ago from Wisconsin where the two girls had decided to sacrifice their friend to Slenderman.
Right.
And for people that aren't familiar, Slenderman is an internet meme character that was basically created or believed to be created for an online contest to try to fool paranormal investigators. Could you create a story and backstory and imagery enough to fool people? And this gentleman came out and created this character known as Slenderman, who was tall, lanky, no face. You couldn't see a face. And was often in the company of children, you would see him. And sometimes he's got these spider-like legs that would unfold from his back. And these girls were very intrigued by the history and story of Slenderman, and they took it to an unbelievable level when they decided to murder one of their friends on a sleepover in order to gain entry to Slenderman's world.
Hmm.
And, I mean, to us rationally, that just sounds completely insane. And here again, you've got not just one, but two children who think, yeah, this makes sense.
Right.
And that in itself is unbelievable. But then they go through all of this and talk about the case and why they did this. And they took this girl, brutally stabbed her and left her for dead multiple times. This girl survived and crawled out of the woods and was able to get help and is alive today. Thank God.
Really? Wow.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And then there was a spate of these weird murders. There was another guy who tried to kill his mother and burn the house down that was doing it in honor of Slenderman. And we start looking at these things called tulpas in the paranormal world, these thought processes and thought forms. If we think about something enough, can we create it? And you know this, right? I mean, creative visualization, a lot of sports people will use that. You see yourself winning. You see yourself hitting that home run or getting the touchdown or winning a title belt. You know, any one of those type of things. You process this. You put this out to the universe, and it brings it to it. Well, the idea is, too, with tulpas in the paranormal world, if we think about something, can we actually create these beings? And what I found fascinating is we started kind of looking back at the idea of what Slender Man was. It was believed he was created as this internet meme, and that's what this guy has told us. However, there are versions of Slender Man that have appeared for centuries in different religions and cultures, and they're all very similar in the storyline. Sometimes they're dressed in different outfits, but usually they're very tall, lanky, no face, no structural features, and almost in the vein of Mothman, they appear and seem to be a precursor to something really evil and wicked coming. So that was what started my research even deeper into some of these weird crimes that had paranormal slants. Or you'd hear some of these crimes where, you know, the Red Barn Ghost, and we're going to cover this in a few weeks on our show with Neil Story from England. But you've got the Red Barn Ghost, this guy in England, he convinced his girlfriend, let's run away together. I guess she was pregnant. Let's run away together. You know, meet me at the Red Barn. We're going to take off. We're going to get out of here. She was very close with her family. But, you know, it was in a way back in the day that just wasn't acceptable. So she shows up, he murders her and hides her body in this Red Barn and then takes off and goes around touring through Europe, sending cards and letters saying she doesn't want anything to do with you anymore and your family. But I'm just letting you know she's okay. Everything's fine. I'm sorry. I don't know why she's like this. Very strange deal. Well, the mother starts getting visits from the spirit of this ghost, of her daughter. And starts to tell her, I'm in the Red Barn. And the mother starts to kick this around. They actually go and investigate, and sure enough, in the Red Barn, they find the remains of her daughter. So you've got this interesting story that, you know, supposedly a ghost led this investigation to a close by telling where her body was located. Then, if that's not weird enough, and this happens right in the United States, there's the Greenbrier Ghost. And I want to say it's North Carolina. They actually have a sign right there that says Greenbrier, home of the Greenbrier Ghost. It's the only ghost story, I guess, ghost account that was found admissible in a court of law. And this guy had married, was very abusive to this woman. She died suddenly. He said she died during childbirth. Nobody in her family knew she was pregnant. There was no proof that she had been pregnant. He was very guarded about letting people near her during the wake. There was a scarf tied around her neck, although she never wore a scarf. And it was just a very weird situation. And he was so adamant about keeping people away from the corpse in the coffin. So after a few weeks of this, the mother started being visited by the daughter, who explained that he had been very violent and had, I believe, thrown her down a flight of stairs, breaking her neck. And you know, that was the deal. And it was enough for the mother to go back to the police, tell them what happened. They exhume the body, pull off the scarf. Sure enough, the neck's been broken. They find everything they need to. So that's where I said, sometimes you get these crossover stories where there's a little twist to the supernatural involved.
Right.
Now in Canada, quite a few years ago, I think like within the last 10 years, there was a young lady, and the names are protected. I'm sure if you look them up online, you can find them, but Canada has it right when it comes to court and how to deal with criminals. They don't publicize the names, and especially if it's a child, you never know about this stuff. It's all kept out of the courts so that they can get fair and just trials. But this girl and her boyfriend, who is older than her, she believed she was a vampire. They were part of this weird coven. He believed he was like a 400-year-old werewolf. and they murdered her family. So she is the youngest serial killer on file in Canada. And, you know, I said that that's, again, now obviously there's some mental issues at play here, and you start to hear these kind of cases that are going around. But, you know, again, it's got that weird paranormal twist to it. And for the Greenbrier, that's West Virginia, just so I mentioned, and that's from 1897. Zona Heister Shue was the girl that was murdered. So you can find all that information online and read a little bit more about it. But it's cool because they actually have that sign up that talks about the Greenbrier ghost and all of the weirdness that kind of follows it. I'm trying to think a couple of the others.
But just let me ask a question. So, when they think he's a werewolf, what does that mean? What is he every month on the full moon? He thinks that he turns into a wolf, or what's the deal?
You'd be surprised how many people actually believe that that there is something to the lycanthropy or the change. And you know, a lot of people also buy into the fact that it's a mental illness. But even going back into the Native American tribes, they believed that they would absorb the essence or have this essence of their animal, their totem animal, and that they could change into these. It doesn't always mean physically, but it was more of a mental thing. And, you know, again, I think these two were just kind of weird Twilight fans who believed that they were vampires and werewolves because it was a sexy thing.
If you believe if you believe you're a vampire, are you actually trying to drink blood as well?
Yes. Yeah, there are these covens where they will go drink blood, and they have familiars. They have these humans that are willing to give the blood. And believe it or not, you see it in a lot of the TV shows. There's that Midnight Texas TV show, which I really enjoy, that's on TV right now. But they, you know, they had a coven of vampires that just visited, if that's the right term I'm using, at a clutch of vampires. I don't know what the proper terminology. Yeah, a gaggle of vampires.
Right.
Maybe gurgle would be better. But, you know, they usually find some willing participant who's willing to give blood.
Wow.
Yeah. It's really bizarre how that all works out. You know, and then you've got some of these reincarnation stories of murder. You know, there's been a few really well-documented cases where a kid just keeps talking about his family in some neighboring village, and they actually take him over there. Like, you've never been there. You're 8 years old, 9 years old. You've never been to this village. He goes to the village, walks through, knows who everybody is, addresses who his wife used to be, then addresses who murdered him. And that was enough to get this guy tried. And sure enough, they found the body. They found out that this guy was the murderer. And this kid had come back all these years later to solve his own death.
Wow.
That's what I said. A lot of it's really fascinating to me that you can find that kind of information and, you know, that it's out there and it's not just twisted cases.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a Ouija board session on November 8th in, I think it was 1933 in Prescott, Arizona. A 15-year-old by the name of Maddie Turley fired a shotgun at her father, Ernest Turley, inflicting mortal wounds. She'd shot him, she said, because the board could not be denied. She eventually pled guilty to attempted murder and was sentenced to a state reformatory where she received parole 3 years later. So that's one of the very first cases of murder by Ouija, where it was telling her to do this heinous crime. Now, the weird thing about it is she did the Ouija with her mother. Her mother was the one operating the planchette during the seance, and the Ouija board told Maddie to shoot Daddy after he milked the cows and assured her no one would discover the murder. And allegedly, Dorothea, the mom, told Maddie she wanted to marry a handsome cowboy and get rid of Ernest Turley, and this was just the easiest solution. So Maddie and her mother used a deck of playing cards to apparently confirm the command, and then the teenager went out and shot her father in the back, and he died later at the hospital. So you've got, you know, again, now in this kind of case, obviously the mom is using the daughter because the daughter is going to get a much less sentence for carrying out this murder. And the mother can deny and say she doesn't know anything about what was going on with this. But there's a case where you're, involving the supernatural.
Mm-hmm. Right. Like, I love how the mother was controlling the plancha. So it's like, you must kill your father. But I mean, there's so many of these. I used to read about them all the time. I remember every Sunday there would be, I think his name was Max something or other, and he was the guy that would write the weekly column about the true crime. Max Haynes, I think was his name. But there's so many of them, fascinating, like you said, kind of in the mind of madness here and delving into the world of like these completely psychopathic people. What other stories really fascinate you, Dave, that have really led you to have this whole True Crime Tuesday show?
Well, unfortunately, like I said, I've had it touch my life a couple
yeah.
of times.
Oh, yeah, you said a couple, newest, yeah.
Newest one was just a few years ago. I was actually on a trip in, I believe it was Scotland or Ireland at the time when we got the news. And as part of the paranormal world, we come into contact with a lot of really interesting and fun people. And as a long mainstay of our shows, we do these live events where we'd go all over the United States, Eastern State Penitentiary, Waverly Hills Sanitarium, the Stanley Hotel, the Queen Mary, all of these great haunted locations. And we would bring celebrities from the different paranormal TV shows and, you know, authorities and speakers on things like Bigfoot. Lauren Coleman would join us, or Dr. Barry Taff. And you'd always have all of these great guests to join in and chat with. And Mark and Debbie Constantino were brought to my attention by my friend out of Reno, Janice Oberding, who's a big investigator and author on the paranormal. She said, you have to meet these two. They are very proficient at getting recordings of the dead, EVP, electronic voice phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
So they came on out to our Stanley Hotel event, and they were set up in one of the areas to lead a ghost hunt during the night, and people were blown away. As a matter of fact, most of the time, the guests would come and want to hang out with the TV celebrities. But because these two were getting so many recorded voices while you're standing there watching it, they never wanted to leave. So these two became celebrities unto themselves, and their names were Mark and Debbie Constantino.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this interesting shtick. They were very much the Bickersons. They were very sweet and loving to all of us and very nice people. But they always, you know, they had this kind of New York sensibility where they just said what they felt. They you know, were kind of brash with one another, and they realized that it kind of worked for their shtick, for their, you know, public persona. So there was always this kind of weird little infighting between the two of them, or disagreements. And over the years, and they worked with me for, I think, 8 years doing these live events, things started to get more and more heated,
mm-hmm.
and just strange outbursts. And people started to wonder, is this the influence of the paranormal? Because they're constantly in contact with the dead, or what we believe is the dead, are they maybe possessed or demon pushed? And I'd seen Debbie on numerous occasions react, and I got to watch this line very carefully, because I know that this is still a very touchy subject for a lot of the people. But Debbie was a very slight woman, very small, very skinny in stature. I mean, just a very slight woman. And Mark was a big guy, built kind of like me, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And Debbie was very violent with him on numerous occasions in front of us. I mean, I remember one time at the Washoe Club in Virginia City, she got mad at him and just crushed her cigarette out in his face while she'd been drinking. And he always remained calm about this, which astounded me, that this guy was so calm. She would hit him, she would put cigarettes out on his face, call him every name in the book, and he'd always be like, come on, Deb, just knock it off. Come on, Deb, stop it. And he was always very calm, which, again, was really an interesting deal. Things continued to escalate. About 2 years ago, they had decided to divorce. Deb moved out, and that caused these waves. And I'd been talking to a few of our friends in the paranormal field, and I said, I got a bad feeling things are not going to go well. And they're like, no, I think this is the best thing. They're finally apart, this negativity, this anger. And then things started to surface that they were basically abusing each other for all this time, and one or the other was always getting the other one arrested for physical abuse, but then they would never go to court to finish the deal and get the person put away. So then they dropped the charges.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this last case, Mark and his daughter went to go get Debbie from her friends, or I guess it had told Debbie her dogs ran away, so Debbie and her friend came over to the house, where Mark and his daughter dragged them allegedly out of their car, beat them up pretty rough, almost choked Debbie to death, and the police were involved. So Mark and his daughter were put away for this and put in jail for a while. And again, we were talking, and you know, amongst our group, we're like, you know, it's sad that we're really not surprised about this.
Right.
But it went from like a kind of a funny shtick of watching these two bicker, and it was funny the way they do it, but you never question that these two loved each other very much. That was the weird part.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, I have a bad feeling about this, Jeff, that if he gets out, I have a feeling they're going to both be dead in about 60 days. And he said, no, I don't think it's going to go that far. Do you? And I said, yeah, I really got a bad feeling this time. And I took off to go do our trip. And I, like I said, I can't remember if it was Ireland or Scotland. And we were a couple days into the trip, and we'd just come back from this really fun ghost tour. Everybody had a great time laughing and having fun, and got back to my hotel room, and one of the guests that was part of our event called me and said, Dave, Mark killed Debbie tonight and then killed himself.
Wow.
And I was blown away. I knew it was coming, but it was still one of those things. It's like watching a car accident. You see it coming in slow motion, but you know there's nothing you can do.
Right.
And what had happened, she had moved out. He actually went over to the house to get her and shot the man. She was living with two people, a woman and a man. He shot the man to death, then dragged Debbie back to their daughter's apartment. While the daughter was gone, she had, I guess, police got involved in this. They had surrounded the building, and he said, just let me think this through, or I'm going to kill her. Just leave me alone. Let me think about this. And they kept trying to communicate, and at one point they heard gunshots, and they finally burst in, and he had already murdered Debbie and then killed himself.
Mm.
So then it rose, you know, oh, well, it was obviously demonic possession or spiritual influence, and I don't think so. I think it was just the mental illness of two people that were very charismatic and very powerful between the two of them, and things got out of control. They were both very possessive of one another. They were sweet people, and I choose to remember not the murderer that he was or the abusive spouse she was, and I know there are just as many stories from behind the scenes that Mark was as abusive. I can just say what I'd seen in public was I never saw him raise a voice or a hand to his wife ever.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, he always walked away from it when it got ugly. But I understand that that was behind the scenes, and there were things we didn't see. We watched this whole thing kind of go down, and it was just tragic to watch this happen as somebody that you love and care about. I like to think about the fact that they gave a lot. They did charity work with us all the time. We would do these live events, and then we would do these special late night ghost hunts where people would donate money, you know, sometimes hundreds or thousands of dollars to go on a private investigation with Mark and Debbie.
Mm.
And they would give all that money to Shriners Children's Hospital, Haven House, the battered woman shelter in Los Angeles, you know, animal rescues, whatever we were raising money for at that time. And that's what I choose to remember about these two. But, you know, it was definitely a tragedy that really kind of catapulted itself into our paranormal world and shook a lot of people when it happened.
But that's the thing. Like, I've been, you know, akin to that myself with the Chris Benoit murders. I'm sure you remember
right.
that, where Chris killed not only his wife and then his son and then himself. And you wonder because, you know, the best guy in the world, super cool. And if I had to leave my kids with somebody, I would think about leaving them with him. And then something like that happens where you're like, how can a person be so capable of doing these horrific, abominable crimes when they're so mild-mannered, friendly, polite, trustworthy, et cetera, every other time of their life?
You know what's fascinating about Chris's story fits another story, and I think may be the answer in those cases. Because if I remember correctly, didn't his father donate his brain to be tested and understood after the fact?
Yes.
He showed that he had a lot of trauma, brain trauma, from the years of sports that he had been involved
in. Yeah, had the CTE problems that you find a lot of athletes are having now.
Right. And now, you know, it's real easy for people out in the world to dismiss that this is a reality. A lot of people don't know that head trauma can cause rage issues.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't even realize if you've had a concussion or two, that can cause rage issues. It has nothing to do with steroids. It has nothing to do with
right.
drugs. And it can fire off in an instant. And Chris, unfortunately, had sustained quite a bit of that in the brain. Well, there's another case, and I'm struggling right now to remember his name, but he's known as the Reluctant Serial Killer. Great guy. Nice guy, and we're working on having him and his ex-girlfriend on our radio show, True Crime Tuesday, here sometime in the near future.
How can you have him on if he's a serial killer? Is he in jail?
Well, he's in jail.
Okay.
He's in jail, but he can make phone calls, and that's what part of the deal is that we're working on is getting this taken care of because it's such a unique story.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a great guy overall, but he sustained a head injury, and then he would go into these weird modes where he would murder, and it wasn't his personality. It wasn't him. And the courts realize that, you know, that these brain injuries can bring out a totally different perspective and aspect of your personality. So that's why he's referred to as the, you know, reluctant serial killer. He has the remorse. It's not like he's broken and completely socially inept. He's able to understand what happened, but that's why I want to get a little bit more into his story. What we've really focused on a lot over the last few years on the show, too, is these cases of people being put away. And Chris, I don't know if you know this, but it's like unbelievable how many people they believe in every state. Like, it's believed that there could be upwards to 200 people that are incarcerated that are innocent.
Really?
The crime that they've been put in for. Yeah, 200. Think about that.
Wow.
And it could be higher. That's just the one that they believe they know about. Up to 200 people per state are incarcerated for crimes they did not commit. And that's because the listen, I love America. I love our criminal justice system, but it is flawed and broken. Prosecutors and defense counsels are not worried about finding justice. They're worried about winning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very scary aspect of real true crime. So here's a quick tip that I've talked to every attorney, both sides have given to me. If you are ever approached by the police regarding any matter to do with a violent crime, do not speak. Do not give admission. And you think, hey, I have nothing to hide. I'm not guilty. I'll just talk. Don't do it. Ask for an attorney.
Why is that?
And, you know, and when you think of that, Chris, right, what's the first thing that comes to mind? Oh, sure. Schrader gets pulled in and asks for an attorney. He must be guilty,
mm-hmm.
right? It's because when you give up the rights and you say, hey, I'm Chris Jericho. I'm a good guy. I raise money for charities. I have nothing to hide. They get you behind closed doors and they start browbeating you. And in some cases, some of these people start almost believing
right.
what they're hearing from the cross examiners there at the police station. And they're in there sometimes for hours, 8, 9 hours, breaking this person down, where it gets to the point that some of these people are just like, okay, I did it. Can we just end this?
Yes.
You know? Or they're told, listen, if you tell me about this, we can go really easy on you. You're not going to get the death penalty. You'll probably be out in a couple of years, but we have enough to nail you. And people fold. You have to ask for an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you can't afford an attorney, they have attorneys that will help you. But it's frightening how many of these defense attorneys that are city and county appointed to you are totally inept and unable to really do the good job. And that was kind of shown to us with the Stephen Avery case and making
right.
him a murderer, right? And you see more and more cases like this. One that's really terrifying, and put your head in this, one of my favorite episodes of True Crime Tuesday from a number of years ago, we probably are going to put it on as a replay for our listeners on True Crime Tuesday as an addendum episode so they get a free one just for checking it out, was all about the story of Tommy Lynn Sells. And Tommy Lynn Sells was a brutal serial killer, horrible guy. And as a matter of fact, when we did the interview about him, he was just about to be put to death. And that was back in April of 2014, I believe. I think we spoke to the author of the book in, I think, March, because his death date was coming up relatively quickly. Here's what's really strange. This author who met with him repeatedly and got his confidence and heard these stories, he would brag to her of these murders that he committed that hadn't been attached to him. As a matter of fact, he gave up enough information about one murder that the author was able to take it to the police. And they imagine this, Chris. Not only do you lose one of your children to a brutal murder, but they arrest you for it.
Wow.
And yeah. you go to prison for the murder of your child.
Ugh.
So you've lost your child. You've lost your innocence. You've lost your freedom and you're put in prison. And I want to say it was almost 15 to 20 years this woman was sitting in jail before they were able to exonerate her. And that's because Tommy Lynn Sells admitted to it to this author, and they got this woman out of jail.
How can that even happen? That's so insane.
And they didn't see, and this is what terrifies the living hell out of me, they didn't see the importance of keeping this man alive longer.
Right.
He didn't want to die. So I don't know why we don't cut a deal with, and listen, you know, for a long time, because of what happened to my friend Deb, I was an eye for an eye kind of guy. And if you're going to murder somebody in cold blood and kill their children, the minute that gavel hit the ground and said guilty, they should have walked him out back and put a bullet in their head. That was my thought for a long time.
Right.
Because I just don't see keeping somebody in society that has that kind of nature. I've softened to that a little bit as I've understood from different people and crimes, and I understand eye for an eye is not always the way to go. But in this case, this guy wanted to, you know, stay alive. If they would have said, all right, listen, you give us two leads. If we can find either one of these bodies and prove that you're attached to it, we'll extend your life by 18 months.
Right.
So for every two leads you give us that flesh out, and the reason you say they've got to flesh out is because a lot of people, like Bundy, in order to save his ass at the end, he got out there and he said, oh, I got all these other, I can help you solve crimes. He was trying to be the Hannibal Lecter.
Right.
But he was also full of BS in a lot of cases. and they would go on wild goose chases and not find what he said was taking place. So, but Tommy Lynn Sells was a different kind of character. And I said, how can we put him to death knowing that there are people on death row for murdering somebody, sometimes family members, and they are not guilty? But to the law, and this is the terrifying part, Chris, you can put me in a room full of demons, witches, ghosts, and goblins. That doesn't terrify me half as much as in the eyes of the law, but we got him for the crimes that we got him for. Let's just put him to death.
Right.
To hell with justice for all the other victims. To hell with justice on all these other cases. Let's just get rid of him. Then yeah. We don't have to worry about Tommy Lynn Sells anymore.
Wow.
And that is what I don't understand. And there are serial killers like that today that still live that have given some cases enough to keep themselves out of harm's way in the way of murder, or I mean, not murder, but death penalty. But I think if we can use that and we can solve these crimes, it's an important thing to do. And we really need to get this done. And we've become such a snowflake society, and I don't like to use the cliche, but everybody's so worried about their rights that they're not worried about doing what's right. Mm-hmm. I don't see the problem with everybody giving a little bit of DNA so we can solve these crimes quicker. We can get this information done. It's not a violation of our privacy. It's a way to crack these crimes and maybe save lives, because had they had the DNA from some of these guys, they may have been able to stop multiple rapes and murders on women and men for years. But people are so, I don't want to give my blood. I don't want to give a cheek scraping. Well, you know, I don't understand that philosophy. Let's stop crime where we can. And if we have these DNA kits in place that we can plug them in, boom, there are thousands of rape and murder DNA kits sitting untested because there's just not enough money, Chris. There are people sitting in jail and in prison for crimes they didn't commit because there's just not enough money to run all of those kits. And listen, we have new crimes to worry about. Let's not try to exonerate Chris Jericho from a crime 20 years ago. He's already in jail. Let's just worry about the new crime.
Right.
Well, how would you feel if you're that guy sitting there going, but wait a minute, you have a kit that you can run that might get me out of jail?
Talk is Jericho.
Well, then what did you think of that? You mentioned Making a Murder and Stephen Avery. What did you think of that? Because that was unbelievable when you watched that show. And obviously, they're showing it from one side of the coin. They want people to think that he's completely innocent. Is that the case? Have you looked into that crime at all?
We looked into that crime before the Netflix series had aired.
Right.
We spoke with Michael Griesbach about it, and it was fascinating. In his opinion, the first crime was completely trumped up. He believes that Stephen Avery was guilty of the second crime.
The second crime of the murder of the photographer?
Right. But I still, you know what, and some of it is very interesting, to say the least. And, you know, his nephew, who has a very low IQ and Brandon Dassey, he was easily manipulated, but he made all of these claims. Now, this is the interesting part. They put Stephen Avery away without Brendan Dassey's testimony. Okay.
Right.
So they didn't use Brendan Dassey to put Stephen Avery away. They had enough that they believe Stephen Avery was the criminal for that crime. But then you've got Brendan Dassey, who says, oh yeah, she was chained or handcuffed to a bed. She was brutally murdered. There was all of this, you know, that took place, and there's no proof. There's no DNA. You don't even see scratches on the headboard from where she would have been chained. And who wouldn't have been handcuffed, have been trying to work their wrists out of that or try to break the headboard to get it out when they were left alone in that room?
Mm-hmm.
And there's no marks. There's no mars. There's no blood splatter. That, to me, seems very strange when you look at this crime. And there are so many people. We just did a follow-up show, I think, a couple months ago about the political side of this and why it was important for them to break him. Because there is the scary part of this story is there's nobody clean in this story. I mean, there's no doubt Avery and Dassey are goofy guys and that they're probably not totally clean of crimes and bad situations, but are they guilty of murder? But tell me why a man who's about to get a multi-million-dollar payoff would give it all up by murdering another woman.
Right. Yeah.
That makes no sense. Now, you can say, well, obviously he's mentally deficient. And I don't know how mentally deficient you are that you're about to get paid and you're going to do something to mess it up. I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have. But again, I mean, I know, like you said, the documentary is slanted one way. But there's still so many other news articles coming out that shed light on different aspects of this story. that it's pretty hard to just say definitively this guy did it. And they're still working behind the scenes to get Dassey out and Avery out. And I think that that case and the fact that they raised that information and that there are still some things to look at means that we need to almost retry that case in a totally different state where we no longer have the political ties and sheriffs and judges and people that are still sitting or in power that have influence over keeping this guy in jail. Because, Chris, if they exonerate this guy again and find out that this was BS, the state of Wisconsin is going to be changed to the name of Avery, right? It'll just be you've got Illinois right next to the state of Avery. This guy's going to own that state.
So, when you were talking to Michael, what did you say his name was? Michael
Griesbach.
And he is the attorney, or who is he?
Yeah, he was one of the attorneys, prosecuting attorneys, I believe, out there.
So he thinks that the first crime, which was the rape, that he did it,
right.
But the second crime of the murder he did not do.
No.
Sorry, vice versa.
The first crime was trumped up, that the rape was not his. He believes that wholeheartedly. He believes that Avery did do the murder.
Wow, okay.
And yeah, it just, and I mean, listen, there are some damning points. Her car is on his property in the junkyard.
Mm-hmm.
There are some weird points to it, but there's no DNA linking it. And then they just happen to find one shell casing in the garage, and that's enough to put him away. I don't know, man. It's an icky situation all the way around. I just don't believe that true justice is going to be served in this case because, like I said, when you go through it step by step, and I'll be happy to give you the guy's name we just talked to, and I don't remember it off the top of my head, but he talks about the political motivation behind this case.
And what's that? What's the political motivation?
Just all of the people behind the scenes who are in positions of power that don't want the truth to come out on the story. And it's not conspiratorial, but you realize that when this peg is removed from this house of cards, there's a lot that's going to collapse real fast.
Right.
And I think that's going to cause, you know, waves. That's why I said I believe this guy's going to own the state of Wisconsin if he is ever exonerated. Now, they might get away with it with the Alford plea like they used for the West Memphis 3, where they'll tell him, all right, listen, we'll let you out, but you're going to sign this that says you can't come after us for money. You can't do it, but we'll give you your freedom back. And, you know, we covered the West Memphis 3 case quite a bit on our show in the past, and that was a case that fascinated me as well. And I will tell you this. There is a gentleman that I firmly believe is the murderer. And I've talked off the record and off air with a few people that are involved in an ongoing investigation on this guy. And there is a death toll following him that people have not put together yet.
A death toll?
Yeah, meaning that there have been other mysterious deaths surrounding this guy.
Wow.
And it has nothing to do with the three guys, Jesse Miss Kelly and Damian Eccles and Jason Baldwin. Has nothing to do with them. They were on trumped-up charges. And, you know, a lot of people are still hung up on the, no, they did it. Look at the way Damian acted. Listen, if you're a smug, and I was a smug teenager, if you know you're innocent of something, and you just think this is a big joke, and there's no way they're going to put you away, I could see being, and he's an egotistical kid.
Mm-hmm.
I could see him just rolling his eyes and kind of laughing about it and, you know, monkeying up to the cameras, because in his opinion, there was no way he was going to be found guilty of this crime.
Well, not to mention they're teenagers, too. We're talking about the West Memphis 3, which is the three teenagers who were accused of murdering one kid or two?
No, three little boys.
Three little boys, and they were in jail for years, what, 20 years or so, something like that? And they finally got out, but they had to sign a paper that said that they had basically done it, but they wouldn't, you know, whatever it was, to save face. But when you're talking about teenage kids, it's like they might be so nervous they might not know what else to do. You know, like, oh, yeah, well, I didn't do it. Well, screw you type thing, you know?
Well, and they got Jesse Miss Kelly, the weak link of the three. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, Jesse, because, you know, that's hurtful to say. But he was the kid that had...
He wasn't as smart. He was slow, right?
Right.
Yeah.
His mental acuity was much less and easily compromised. But for God's sakes, Jason Baldwin, they have proof that he wasn't anywhere near it and that he was at, like, I think a school function or a basketball game or something. They have proof on these guys that they weren't there, but what they did was Jesse Miss Kelly did not have representation while they questioned him, and they broke him down for hours.
Right.
The video is telling. And, you know, they break this kid down, and basically they're telling him, listen, we already know what happened, so if you just confirm this for us, and they lead him through this admission, And that's horrific. And, for, you know, that was another case where they knew that they screwed up this case in a huge way. That's why they offered this Alford plea. And Jason Baldwin did not want to sign the Alford plea, but they all three had to do it in order to get Damien Echols off the death. You know, he was going to be put to death.
Yeah, he was one that was on death row for being the ringleader.
Right. And Baldwin did the right thing and stepped up. And, well, I shouldn't say he did the right thing. He did the thing to save his friend. And he firmly believes that they were all screwed and they gave up a huge portion of their life for this. And they have nothing to get back for it. You know, there's always going to be that stigma of,
sure, of course,
crime associated, even though most of the world believes they're innocent. I mean, boy, you talk about a turnout. They had every celebrity under the sun in their case trying to help them out. Peter Jackson, Seth Rollins, Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp, yeah.
A few big shirts.
So, it's funny. I hosted an award show a few years ago, and Johnny Depp was play guitar with Marilyn Manson on the show. And Damien Echols was there because he was a big heavy metal fan. And after the show, I'm the host. I couldn't get into the room to hang out with Johnny Depp and Damien Echols. I wasn't a big enough name to get into the room. I'm like, but I hosted the show. They're like, nope, this is only for like the top guys, including Damien Echols.
Well, yeah.
You know?
Well, and there's been, unfortunately, I've understood, Damien blew me off twice. We had him scheduled for our show, and then I had him scheduled for Coast to Coast AM, and he blew me off both times at the last minute. So I'm not a big fan of Damien Echols for that fact. I mean, I certainly believe that they were innocent and were railroaded, but I've heard he kind of allegedly has screwed over the other two since this took place and has sold his story and kind of screwed their rights up. Mm. This is allegedly, I don't know this to be 100% true, but like I said, I have full confidence that the truth of that case still exists out there, and I believe that they're getting closer and closer to really solving it. So when you think that that case is just being left dangling, it's not. There are people behind the scenes.
You watch the movies for it, and I think it was the stepfather or something like that was involved, or there's a lot of, once again, suspects that are much more obvious than the kids. But I think what you said, though, Dave, is something that's it's very terrifying in that there's a lot of politics involved to where, okay, we know that Echols is innocent. We know that Stephen Avery is innocent, but we have to leave them in jail because if not, we look bad. And let's just leave them in there rather than bring them out because it's going to make the whole state look bad and make us all look like idiots. Like you said, if that happens, he would own the whole state. So if I'm in charge of the justice system of Wisconsin, I don't want Stephen Avery to get out, even if he is completely innocent, because that makes me look bad.
Yeah. So watch for that Alford plea. If he ever gets out, I don't see it any other way than an Alford plea, unless it's his ego in the way saying, I don't want the Alford plea. I just want to go back to court. Then I think Stephen Avery's a dead man in true opinion.
Sure.
But there are other cases like this. And again, I'm sorry, I'm not more prepared on this right now, but we're kind of going off on a different pathway. But we did a show that fascinated the hell out of me. There was this black soccer coach from a foreign country living here, and he was railroaded for the murder of a woman's son. And it's a tragic story. But what's really scary about the whole thing is the police only focused on this one guy, period. That's all they focused on. Well, he had a key, he had access, and he had broken up with this woman, and they had had some issues in the past. Okay, that was enough. Well, they lived in a very affluent neighborhood, and black people in that neighborhood were just not seen. It just didn't happen, and if they did, they stuck out. Nobody saw this guy. He has proof that he was other places. They claim that he had injured his leg jumping from the window, and they have video of him showing this, but there's no proof of this. And the story, and we actually, it was really nice. The attorneys and the people behind it said that they believe that presenting on our show helped get them cleared because it's bringing it out to the public and letting people know what's going on with this case. And, when it was finally kind of cleared up for them, they came back on to thank us for the work that we did on our show. And this was just crazy to me because this guy, and here's the twist, her other ex-boyfriend, who also had motive and violent tendencies, is the policeman that was the investigator on the case.
Wow.
So see, again, go, I'm not saying he did it, but they refused to look at him as a potential. How do you look at him? Now, they found, I believe it was pubic hair and blood, and it did not match. There is no DNA that puts this guy on the scene. There were fibers. There is nothing that matches this guy, not in any way, shape, or form as having been the criminal. But the prosecutors, and I think the district attorney that was running, or the person that was running for district attorney, used him as a linchpin. They're like, we're going to get this son of a bitch. We're going to bring him down because he did this. And that was kind of the cornerstone of her getting into court and getting the DA position. And it's terrifying that, again, it wasn't about justice. It's about winning.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's all they were focused on, was winning at any cost, including the innocence of a man who's now in prison or was going to face prison for this. So there are still a couple of sticky ties out there that they're trying to get through. But for the most part, they've proven his innocence. There's nothing that puts this guy on the site. There's nothing that proves that he was there, and there's no DNA. However, they haven't tested the police officer who's the ex-boyfriend, and they refuse to.
Hmm.
Why?
Yeah, right.
Clear him. Clear him. Hey, let's rub it in the faces of all the conspiratorial idiots then and say, look, okay, fine, here's the DNA test. Are you happy now? But why not run it? That seems really bizarre to me.
Well, absolutely. And like I said, it becomes a political thing rather than a justice thing. And that's the scary, because I think to me that's the worst nightmare of getting put in jail for a crime that you didn't commit. Right.
Right.
But, you know, as we wind down here, Dave, I want you to tell me maybe favorite isn't the best word because it's making it kind of sound trivial and light. But what is the most fascinating true crime story that you've discovered over the last 3, 4, 5 years that you've been doing this show?
That's like asking me who's my favorite kid. It just depends on the week and the case. I mean, when we talked about the Stephen Avery case before it broke, and then we talked about it afterwards, what a great story. Mm-hmm. But I've been involved and wrapped up in the West Memphis 3 case since it broke on HBO Films with the documentaries that they did.
Right.
And then, like I said, and again, I apologize. I'll try to get you the name so you can let your audience know in the future. But the guy we just spoke about that was the soccer coach that mm-hmm. was in trouble. You've got a myriad of these cases. Even here's one, our one of our very first episodes. As a matter of fact, the first episode I ever did of Coast to Coast, I had Jeff Mudgett on our show. And Jeff is the great-great-grandson of H.H. Holmes, the devil in the White City, the killer in Chicago who built the murder castle. And Jeff,
what's that? What's the murder castle? Tell us about that.
Oh my gosh. There's a series on History. And if you haven't seen it, check it out. It's called American Ripper. And it stars Jeff Mudgett and Amaryllis Fox. And they are, Jeff's the great, great grandson of H.H. Holmes. And Amaryllis Fox is an investigator and I believe former CIA investigator. And they look and break this case down, and it's chilling to hear these deals, but he was a genius and built this, what they call the murder castle, right downtown Chicago. It was a few blocks away from the state fair, that World's Fair that took place there.
Mm-hmm.
It had false doors. It had trap doors. It had body chutes. And this guy was experimenting on people and testing people and brutally murdering people. And he left this wake of death in his path that you can't deny. And he was a con man from start to finish. And Jeff believes, from information that he was able to uncover through the family, that Holmes was also the Ripper, which again sounds, you know, Jack the Ripper, which sounds like it's a pretty big leap. But they make a pretty compelling statement, because this guy was constantly embroiled in some con after another. And for the entire time of the Jack the Ripper files, this guy disappears. And there's absolutely no trace of him here in the United States.
Hmm.
But there is mention of him being in England at the time. So you see these tentative murders slowly building up and amping up. And the final one, Mary Jane Kelly, that's where he had her alone in the room. It wasn't out in some dark, dirty alley where he had to be quick. He took Mary Jane Kelly and slaughtered her, carved her up, and did horrific things. And then suddenly comes back and the murder castle is built, a place where he can have all the time in the world. He would turn gas on in people's rooms to kill them. He was an opportunist, so he didn't want to go to fight them, but the doors would lock, the gas would go on in the rooms, they would fall asleep and never wake back up, and then he would do horrific things and then sell the bones or body parts to local hospitals.
Really?
So this, yeah, and he would take, he would take life insurance policies on a lot of these people and just keep cashing them in. It's crazy what this guy got away with.
This is in the 1800s, I guess?
Yeah, and it's just a bizarre storyline. But you've got to, you know, it's on History Channel. It's called American Ripper. And I just had him on Coast to Coast again with me, with Amaryllis, talking about this case. But there, you know, there's another really amazing doctor named Francis Tumblety, who is an American doctor who's also suspected. And one thing that they do admit is they believe this was an American, and it wasn't a racial kind of thing by saying that, but it was just a lot of the way it happened. And Tumblety looks a lot like the drawings that the Ripper of the Ripper, and looks like photographs of H.H. Holmes as well. So both of them were there. Both of them were active. So it could have been these two guys out there, and it could have been either one of them. But in a lot of the Ripper cases, he would remove internal organs, especially the reproductive system organs. And guess what Francis Tumblety used to do? He used to have jars, and he would show some of his friends these jars of uteruses and things that he had. And that's what was always being removed from these victims. So there's some really strange cases. So that one is really one that fascinates me. There are so many dark, twisted angles. And will we ever get an answer? Probably not, because it's good to not know, because that's really good for speculation and for tourism, which is sad to say.
Yeah,
but
right.
That's the case. But it's week after week, there's different angles of stories. You know, we had we just had a woman on that we did a historical talk. You know, she loved her family and then finds out years later that her grandfather was behind mass murders during World War II and was an SS agent and a bigwig, signed off on all these murders. And, you know, you start to look at these stories. So it just kind of depends on the week what fascinates
sure.
you most.
Sure. I'm still kind of stuck on the murder castle, because that's something that you see in a horror movie. You see that, all like, right. in Saw or whatever. And to think that those places actually exists, that's scary. You know, it's creepy, man. It's like
and
I said.
He was building a second one, too. That's why I said watch American Ripper on History, History Channel.
Is it a documentary or is it like
I think it was an 8-part series.
Okay. Yeah, I'll have to check that out. Because
you'll love it. It's fascinating.
Because it's just like when you talk about, I don't know, like The Walking Dead, for example, the show, it's not about the zombies. It's about how evil the humans can be to each other. And that's what scares me, just how evil some people are in this world that we've been talking about over the last hour.
And if people like this and are intrigued and want to know more, just give us a try. Here's the easiest way to sign up. You go to darknessradio.com, darknessradio.com. Click on the True Crime Tuesday banner, and you can subscribe there. And this is the big deal. $5 a month, less than a coffee at Starbucks or
right.
Caribou, or wherever you go. For $5, you get four to five episodes a month that are 90 to 120 minutes long, commercial-free, and it gives you some of the most twisted and bizarre cases. And then, like I said, a lot of times we wrap it up with true crime, dumb crime, stupid criminal, so we'll have a good laugh. We're also doing this thing, Chris. We put out a call a long time ago when we were on iHeartRadio doing the True Crime Tuesday. And I said, hey, do you know a murderer? And we started getting a flood of emails. And we've had a lot of those people asking, can we ask that again? So even if you're listeners, if you knew a murderer, then email me and tell me the story. Dave@darknessradio.com. And we may share those on upcoming episodes of True Crime Tuesday. So Dave@darknessradio.com is the best way to reach me, whether you are into the paranormal and have your own story to share, or when we read those on Monday night shows, or if you've got true crime stories that you want to share or think would be great for us to cover, you can email me at Dave@darknessradio.com. But for $5 a month,
yeah,
4 to 5 episodes, 90 to 120 minutes long, we have some fun with the true crime, dumb crime angle, and stupid criminals. As a matter of fact,
let's end it off with that, Dave. End it off with a dumb criminal story.
Oh, I got to pull this up for you, Chris, because I laughed myself sick about this story. hold on 1 second,
this is kind of like the Darwin Awards, where you check and see like the people, the dumb deaths that people have. Like the one guy, he was an elephant cleaner at the New York City Zoo, and the elephant was constipated, and he unplugged the elephant and you got buried in like, you know, 5 tons of elephant shit. So yeah. Like, I hope I never end up on the Darwin list of stupid deaths.
This was the story I lost it the other day on the show, and I will try to keep myself together on this one, but this is just a perfect example. This is from Pine Grove, Pennsylvania. A state prison inmate and his girlfriend have been charged in a murder for hire plot, foiled by an undercover police officer posing as a go-between. She was this supposed hit woman, and her name was Joni Pepperoni. Joni Pepperoni.
That's her real name?
her name is Lorraine Patterson.
Okay.
Lorraine and Gregory Rouser were the two that were trying to hire her. They were charged Monday back in 2016, I believe it was, with criminal solicitation to commit homicide and conspiracy. Rauser is an inmate at the State Correctional Institution, Pine Grove, about 50 miles northeast of Pittsburgh. And according to the criminal complaint, the pair wanted to kill Randy Walters, whom Rauser had targeted before. Rauser was convicted of shooting Walters back in 2008 and trying to have him killed in another foiled murder-for-hire plot in 2009. So after a fellow inmate tipped off police in August, a trooper, a female trooper, posed as a woman named Joni Pepperoni as a hitman and received $1,000 of the agreed-upon $5,000 for the hit from Patterson last month back in 2016. Online court records don't list any attorney for the defendants, but I just love the fact that this guy and his fiance were so dumb that the deep web scour came up with a killer named Joni Pepperoni, and that didn't send off a bunch of signals. So I just love, and we've got stories like that and some funny ones. And Florida man, it seems to reign supreme in our world with crazy crimes. And I don't know if you're familiar with Florida, Chris Jericho, but it is a crazy place filled with crazy crimes and some of the most loony stories. And we love reading about them every week. So we share those with our listeners, and we have a good laugh or two over that. So you can check that out, like I said, every week by going to darknessradio.com and signing up now by clicking on the True Crime Tuesday banner. And then make sure you check out the Jericho Network here on Podcast One, because aside from just listening to great programming and the great myriad of different topics that Chris covers, he's got his own network, and you've got a lot of great speakers on there that are fun, entertaining, interesting, including what I hear is one of the best paranormal talk radio shows in the business. You've got it part of your network, Chris.
I know. You guys are a huge hit, too. You're the biggest show in the network, and it's going really good, and excited to have you guys aboard, man. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Dave. And like I said,
talking with you. Thank you for having me on. Yeah,
interesting stuff. We'll have you come back to tell some more tales very soon.
Great. I appreciate that. And I'll gather a bunch of fun, dumb crimes and stupid criminals for my next visit for you.
Yeah, please.
All right.
All right, Dave. Thanks, man.
All right. Thanks to Dave Schrader. He does the True Crime Tuesdays every week on Patreon. You can subscribe for $5 and get a new True Crime episode commercial free every Tuesday. And of course, you can hear Dave and his partner and producer, Tim Dennis, Monday to Friday on Beyond the Darkness podcast, the best paranormal podcast out there. Subscribe for free at Apple Podcasts. All right. Dave and Tim will also be on Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. They'll be doing some live Beyond the Darkness podcast, maybe some true crime stories as well, telling some scary stories on the ship, making sure that you're terrified on Halloween. It's not too late to book your cabin. Remember, $150 deposit is minimum, and you can get your spot on ChrisJerichoCruise.com. But you got to hurry up, because all of those cabins are getting filled up and selling quickly. We're moving, man. We got a lot of sales over the last week. The best sales week we've had since we went on sale in mid-September. Do not miss out on this cruise. It's going to be the vacation of a lifetime. I guarantee it. We set sail October 27th. And remember, when you reserve your cabin at ChrisJerichoCruise.com, everything is included in the price. All the food, all the activities, all the live podcasts, stand-up comedy shows, meet and greets, concerts, all that is included in the price of your cabin. You pay for alcohol and gambling, and that's it. If you don't do any of those things, everything else is all-inclusive. And you'll be able to come hang out on the ship with all the incredible guests. Remember, all the meet and greets, free, included with your cabin. All the signings, free, included with your cabin. You want to take a picture with Jim Ross? It's free. You want to go see a Mick Foley's comedy show? It's free. You want to go watch King play a great rock and roll show? It's free. You want to watch Jim Brewer bring down the house with his laughs? It's free. You want to go to the Sea of Honor tournament held by Ring of Honor? That is free as well. All of it, all-inclusive. ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Come hang out and be a part of it. And rub elbows with Jim Ross, Jerry the King Lawler, SoCal Val, Mick Foley, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, Rey Mysterio, Raven, the Keepin' It 100 crew, Conan, Disco Inferno, Shane Helms, Don Callis and Paul Lazenby doing a live Killin' the Town podcast, Cole Cabana and Marty DeRosa doing the Unprofessional Wrestling Show. This is hilarious. Think Mystery Science Theater. Marty and Colt go on stage and tell, watch old bad wrestling tapes and give their opinions on it, the commentary. Brad Williams, comedy. Ron Funches, comedy. Jim Brewer, comedy. Jim's also got the Loud and Rowdy, his great rock and roll band will be playing. Busted Open Radio will be there. Dave LaGreca and whoever he plans to bring. Maybe it's Bully Ray. Phil Campbell and the Bastard Sons will be rocking. Fozzy, the Painless video comes out next week. That's the scoop for you. King will be there. The Stir, Atlanta's finest rock and roll band. The Dave Spivak Project. Speewee has been on the show many times here on Talk is Jericho. Check out his new video, Get Out of My House, on YouTube now. It's very well done. The Darlings of Rock and Roll. roll, the Cherry Bombs. Happy birthday to Alicia Dove. She was in the Judas video. She's also in the Painless video, Breathing Fire. They won't be breathing fire on the cruise ship, but they're going to be rocking, put on a great show. Shoot to Thrill, the world's best female AC/DC cover band. Blizzard of Ozzy, the world's best Ozzy cover band. And, of course, the coup de grace, pièce de résistance, Ring of Honor, presenting the Sea of Honor tournament aboard the ship. Matches happening in the middle of the ocean on a ring that's been tethered down to the cruise ship. It's not going anywhere. It's going to be a lot of great matches and a lot of great talent coming. And remember, the winner of the Sea of Honor tournament gets a Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Championship shot in the future. The Young Bucks will be there. The villain, Marty Scurll. What a great entrance he had at the Tokyo Dome on January 4th. The Briscoe Brothers, Dalton Castle, Frankie Kazarian, newly announced Christopher Daniels will be there. Adam Page, the American Nightmare, Cody, don't call him Rhodes, Cody's wife, Brandy, and we'll be announcing even more big talent in the upcoming weeks. And thanks again to all of you who have checked out the brand new season of my digital series, my digital comedy series, But I'm Chris Jericho, at butimchrisjericho.com. Please go check that out. It's very, very funny. I know you're going to love it. And thank you. Speaking of funny, great to have back this Wednesday Andy Biersack from the Blackville Brides, one of my favorite guests, great, great, well-spoken guy, fellow Kiss fanatic. The Black Veil Brides' new record, Veil, just came out, and the band just hit the road. We're going to catch up with Andy to hear all about it. Andy Biersack returns on Wednesday. In the meantime and in between time, have a great weekend. Stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy.